Joel is a member. I hope I'm not giving up his anonymity, but he's a member of AA, and he might tell you that. And I'm assuming he will. And I consider him also a friend. Hey, I've known Joel for a few years now, attending the same morning meetings and things like that. And I really like where Joel comes from. I don't know whether it's because there's some similarities in us, but Joel's he's got a lot of kind of military in him, and very methodical in his thinking and things, and I really enjoy watching and being with Joel in his growth, and I get to grow next to him, so I'm really happy about that. So without further ado, please help me in welcoming Joel to the podium.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Joel Peterson. I'm a member of AA, and I am an alcoholic. I'm grateful to be here today, grateful to be sober, and the opportunity to speak. Thanks very much, Mike, for inviting me. My sponsor is also here, Randy, in the back. I can see you. And for any other friends that I may not acknowledge at this time, I'm glad that you're here. For anybody who's new to coming back or just recently coming to the program, welcome. And I hope that I'm able to say a couple of things that may resonate with you. So I've got 60 minutes. I've got a timer here. I'll try to keep to that. It's good that they've got me placed right here because usually I like to walk around and talk. So I'll stay placed right here and hopefully I'll be able to carry on the conversation there. I recognize that there's some young ones here as well, so I'll try and definitely keep this as PG as I can. And hopefully we'll get some information out there. So yeah, my name is Joel. I was born in Saskatoon, and I'm going to give you a kind of a chronological, and then we'll kind of recap a few things. Come from what's called the 60 scoop that you may have heard of. Some people have heard of. I was adopted as a baby, and great family I grew up with. Both my parents, university educated, and I was able to have a lot of opportunities that I probably would not have gotten if I had stayed on the res way up north. With that being said, I missed out on a lot of things, and I don't think I really recognized that until I got older. That being said, I don't feel that my story, a lot of people assume like the 60 scoop is a negative thing for me. I don't see it as a negative thing. I think it's part of my journey, and I see it as a positive thing. I grew up in Brandon, Manitoba. My dad was an editorial page editor with the Sun there, the Brandon Sun. And my mom worked for the Government of Canada, bringing in the refugees from Vietnam in the early 80s. So she had a lot of work with that, and I was able to have a lot of meet a lot of interesting people from different countries and different cultures. So it was really, really interesting as a young kid. My first experience with alcohol was at a young age. It was right around that time, actually. And I really liked it. I liked it a lot. My parents used to make wine. It was one of those kind of hippie things that they liked to do back then. Maybe still do. I don't know. Needless to say, there used to be a lot of wine in the cellar. And I remember one time my friends and I snuck a bottle and gave it a try. And it was instant. It was like, wow, this is really awesome. This is the way it makes me feel. Didn't really recognize what it was doing or where it was taking me to. Needless to say, right around that time, that young age, my parents ended up separating and divorcing, and my dad ended up moving up back out east to Ontario, and my mom, we stayed in Brandon for a while, and then we moved to Prince Albert, and we started a blended family in Prince Albert. So that's kind of where my drinking career really started, was in Prince Albert as a teenager. I played a lot of sports, and I still do. I'm very active. And I was very naturally gifted in a lot of sports, soccer, hockey, any of the team sports. And it really helped me in a lot of social things in that aspect. But I always kind of regressed back to alcohol for escapism. And only now, as I'm an adult and much older, can I recognize that part and the escapism with alcohol. I was very functional as far as drinking in school and socializing, et cetera. And I definitely, once the high school years started to kick in, alcohol was a big part of it. Drugs is always there, but for whatever reason, I didn't really want to get involved in it. For whatever reason, I didn't. I had friends that did, and for whatever reason, they respected the fact that I didn't want to do marijuana, hash, any of those kind of softer type drugs back in the late 80s. As I moved forward into high school, and as I was finishing high school, I needed to get a job, and my dad had been in the Army Reserves going through university. He went to the University of Carleton in Ottawa. And he went through an ROTP program, it was called back then. Excuse me, I'm just going to have to drink some water here. So it helped him get through university, and it also provided him some tools with some principles and some direction and some discipline. And unbeknownst to me, I think that was kind of segued into a lot of my growing up. It wasn't anything like a militant type of thing like that, but it was, you know, there was some discipline in place, and it definitely guided me as I started to move forward. My mother was also in the Army Reserves when she was going through university, and that's how they met. And on her side of the family, history going back to World War I, where all of her family had served. So in my family, on my mother's side, on my adoptive family side, there's a lot of history within our family of military service. So at a young age, at 17, I joined the Army Reserves, joined the infantry. And it was something that really, I was always drawn to it. When I was a kid growing up in Brandon, Shiloh is an Army base just down the road from Brandon. My dad used to take me out to what used to be called Armed Forces Day. So my first ride in the back of an APC, I think I was probably about these guys' age, I was probably about 6 or 7. And I remembered the movements and the smell and everything that was going on there. And as soon as I had the opportunity to actually be in that world as a young person, as a teenager, but being with adults, things started to change. It's a different culture in the military. It's a culture of... It's hard to really describe, but what I found was there's a cohesiveness, there's an attraction, because there's a sense of, there's a number of principles that we follow, there's a code that we follow. And if anybody who's in AA and knows history of this, the big book, and the two fellows that put it together, one of them was a former Army guy, go figure, right? So a number of principles, a number of codes and expectations with discipline. When I joined the Army, hanging out with older guys, 20, 25-year-old guys, and we have what in the military called a mess culture. And what that means is the mess is a place where you kind of hang out. Now, there's different tiers in the military, and I joined as a private, so that's a non-commissioned officer ranking. And then there's the commissioned officers, where it starts off with lieutenants, and it's the captains and majors and lieutenant colonels and colonels kind of all hang out over there. And the troopies kind of all hang out over here. And in the middle is where the middle management, the sergeants and the warrant officers, that's where they are. So as I started off as a young soldier, looking up to these people and seeing how they were dealing with their stress, and how we dealt with it was by drinking. Drinking and fighting, that's kind of what we did. We always made up afterwards, even if you had some things that you didn't agree on. But it was in around that time where I was starting to become, what did I really want to do with my life? When I finished high school, I started university out of Prince Albert, but I was still also able to do the military. And I really enjoyed that time in the military, because I was able to do a lot of things quite rapidly. I moved quite quickly through the ranks as a young soldier. And I was provided a lot of responsibility, and it really benefited me as I moved forward. My long-term goal at that point was not a lot. It was, get a paycheck, hang out with my buddies, drink some beer, and hopefully not get picked up by the cops. And most of that time, it worked. Every once in a while, we did have a little run-in with the cops, but they were usually pretty understanding, because they kind of come from the same culture. So, you know, that early part of growing up and that family dynamics where there was a sense of identity challenges for me. But when I joined the military, that was my identity. That's where I found my people almost. Even though we were of different race, different culture, different family dynamics, we all met together and that's where we grew. And for anybody that's either been in that type of world, you'll know what I talk about when I'm saying that the brotherhood that is tied in there is hard to find anything similar to that, I would suggest. I know that there's a lot of careers out there that you will find an understanding or a mosaic where you're enriched together and you grow together, but I would suggest to you that the military in particular, because of the requirement of the job that you have to do, you get pretty close together. So my point on this one is, in that time frame of growing up early and into that late teenage years of enhancing my alcoholic drinking and activities, I was still being successful. I wasn't losing anything. I really hadn't gotten in any trouble. I really hadn't caused any direct pain that I could see or I could feel. And that's the feeling part. So when I recognized the fact that I needed to move on, and I ended up getting a really good career after not completing university, because at that point school wasn't that important to me. And as I moved on forward and became involved in my career, I was still successful, but I was noticing that there was times where alcohol was starting to get in the way now, because I was starting to call in sick and starting to miss some work. And I knew that it was affecting me, and I knew that some of the choices I was making was wrong. And with that being said, it also bothered me, because on part of what I had to do is I had to ensure that certain things that certain people were doing was not acceptable, yet all my peers were doing the same thing. And so there was a hard to balance those two worlds. So at a point, I decided to stop drinking. That point, I wanted to quit a couple of times. I quit a number of times, really. You know, you wake up hungover and you're like, okay, I'm never going to do that again. That wasn't a good scene. But, you know, there was a point where I had finally met somebody and I wanted to have a life with her. And we were going to have a family. And we decided that between the two of us, we knew that if we were going to continue drinking, there wasn't going to be a future. So we agreed to stop drinking. And so she had already been to 12-step programs. I had never heard of 12-step programs before, ever. I had never heard of AA, never heard of Al-Anon. So after one of our challenging discussions fueled by alcohol the next morning, it was agreed that we would go to AA. So I went to AA, not really willingly, but with a sort of a hidden agenda, because I figured if I went to AA, it would make this person happy and we're good to go. So we went to AA. I was hungover. I had my ball cap down really tight. You've seen these people in the rooms, because I was one of them. Ball cap down, hungover, not wanting to be there. Everybody being very polite, you know, and genuine. But I didn't recognize that. You know, people were saying, you know, keep coming back and fake it till you make it, and one day at a time, one step at a time, read the big book, get a sponsor, keep coming to meetings, just don't drink. Got it. That's all I had to hear. Just don't drink. I'm like, I got this. Let's go. We're out of here. So, you know, I did what I like to call the Joel program for about 10 years. And I didn't drink alcohol at all. Because partially now, looking back at it, and I can kind of joke about it now, but my ego is so huge, and I thought I was so in control that, well, I can quit drinking, no problem, done. Next. What's my next task? Right? So I figured, you know what, if I can quit drinking, I can quit smoking. Done. Quit smoking. What am I going to do next? So we ended up raising a family. She didn't drink either. And then there was probably that 10-year time span. And often now I reflect on that and I look back at that time span, at that 10 years. And, you know, there was some good times. We had a family. We had some trips, we have those things that families do, but what was missing was happiness, you know? For anybody that's, you know, taken philosophy or has read anything about happiness, Plato, Aristotle, that's what the essence has always been. What is happiness? What does it mean to you? And I know for me, at that point, I wasn't happy. I was an unhappy person. I was unhappy in my relationship. I didn't have what I needed. Yeah, I had a really great job, and I had a great house in Arbor Creek, and had two vehicles, had a dog, had two, then three kids. It was awesome, sort of, because I felt like I was missing something. And so the Afghanistan war kicked up, and actually I was still in the military, and I still am part-time. And there were some opportunities for me to travel and see the world again, because I had done that before I had started my career. I had done a tour in the Middle East with the United Nations during the first Gulf War, on a little island called Cyprus. So I felt that I had kind of done my duty back then, and that was kind of the tagline that I had told my wife at the time too, because we had in between that time, and I apologize if I bounce around the story a little bit, I'll try to keep it on track, but there was a conflict in Bosnia and Herzegovina, as well as Yugoslavia in this time frame too, and she made me promise her that I wouldn't go. I said, yeah, don't worry, I'm not going to go. I've already done my tour. Stay here. I'll train the troops. That's what I'm doing. But then Afghanistan came up, and that 10-year area came around. And I was like, I'm out of here. I am so done with this relationship. I'm so done with this life. I'm going to Afghanistan. So put my name in, put my papers in. I needed to ensure a couple of things, though. A couple of important things for me. I needed to ensure that my family would be financially looked after while I was gone, so there would be no change in lifestyle. So I'm like, well, what's the problem? I've always been providing for you. You've always had a roof over your house, over your head. You've always had money to spend. What's the difference? I'm just not going to be here. Shouldn't be a problem. So when I had done that, I kind of neglected to tell her that I was planning on going for a year to a war zone. And you know, needless to say, I didn't bat an eye. I'm like, what's your problem? It's my choice. Because it's my show. Still not really getting it at that point. There's a part of that, too, in shortly after that time, I had gotten a back injury, a pretty bad back injury. I used to jump out of airplanes and rappel out of helicopters and a lot of hard things on my body. And I guess it finally kind of wore down somewhat. And after a meeting with a chiropractor, I had a little bit of an over-adjustment that ended me up in the hospital on morphine IV. So, you know, I say that I've never taken drugs, but I actually know what it feels like to be high on narcotics, and I know what it feels like to have the pain that some people have every day, a chronic pain. I understand what that feels like. But the takeaway from that one was that my body healed, my spirit healed, my mind didn't heal, and again the ego kind of got inflated because I was like, I could kick narcotics. I could probably have a beer. So I used to call it the narcotic cocktail I would have, and everything from like T3s to morphine, and it was a crazy little time in that time span. But my mind was still not healthy, and I wasn't a healthy person at all. But in my mind, I was like, okay, I can do this. I can quit drinking. I can quit smoking. I can quit taking narcotics. I can wean myself off of that. I am the show. I will make it happen. Let's go. And that's part of it, too. I found that nothing could keep up to me. My wife couldn't keep up to me. My family couldn't keep up to me. My colleagues couldn't keep up to me. I always wanted something more. I was always running faster, pushing harder, wanting people to follow me. Now, again, some of that is intuitive. Some of that is learned behavior from the military, from paramilitary type training that I've had. It's leadership. There's principles of leadership that I use each day as the same I use the principles of AA, the 12 steps that I use. Each and every day, everything I do, I always have. And so when I decided to take that drink, it wasn't really, again, not really thinking about it. And I don't blame my wife, but she also was struggling. I would suggest she'd probably argue with me because that's what ex-wives do, right? And ex-husbands, right? But I would suggest that, you know, she also wanted to try drinking again. She missed that. So together we agreed. It was an agreement that we would go out, we'd have a few beers, see what it was like. And I'll tell you here, team, as soon as I took that first drink, it was instant. It kicked me back 10 years earlier. Not even the narcotics and stuff, it wasn't the same. I found my senses heightened. I could smell. I could hear, even though I know auditory is impaired by alcohol. I could see. And when I was seeing, it was slower because it was impaired. Taste, it was all enhanced. I found it that way anyways. And at first, it wasn't enough. I couldn't get enough. I had a six-pack of Heineken. And one of the reasons why I wanted Heineken, it wasn't really my drink of choice, but when I had been a number of years earlier, myself and a group of army guys were on leave in Europe, and we ended up in Amsterdam. And for anybody that's been in Amsterdam, as soon as you get off the train in Amsterdam, the Heineken brewery is right there. It says Heineken. It's like, dun, dun, dun. It's like, is this real? Is this a dream? And so I remember at that time, because I was definitely drinking and I was an alcoholic then as well, but the Heineken was like water. Not like light beer, it was like water. And so that's what I wanted. And when I started drinking again, it wasn't the same. But what I found was that I had to have more, and it was almost back to, like I said, when I had quit 10 years earlier. But now there was the other things that was going with that. It was all the lies, and the deceit, and the dishonesty that had always been along in the 10 years, going all the way along that time. And the other thing that I should have mentioned earlier, too, was I had a big book. And for those of you that have moved from time to time and you have those three or four boxes that never really get unpacked when you move, I had a big book that was given to me when I first quit drinking by a good friend of mine, his mom. And it was a second edition big book. I still have it. But it followed me in all those moves. And the first time I got it, I didn't open it at all. I didn't open it for, well, I guess it would have been like 12 years. 12 years that book followed me around. It's like this one book I have from my first year class about philosophy. It's called NATO to Plato. It's my favorite book. I don't know why. I didn't even get very good marks in that class, but I liked it. So those two books followed me around. And when it was time to open it, I did. So again, backing up just slightly here. So, you know, that time when I started drinking, the challenges were happening. I put in for Afghanistan because it really didn't click in until I'd been in the program for a little while again when people talk about geographical changes and craziness. I never thought I was crazy. Some people look at me, you did what? You wanted to go where? Well, yeah, that was my escape. But it was also part of my job because I was sending soldiers there who I had trained and I wanted to be there with them and I wanted to bring them back. So needless to say, I actually did not end up deploying. About a year into the application as a processing, the mission in Afghanistan changed and the position that I was allocated for was zip, it was gone. So they said, Joel, if you want to go to Afghanistan, you'll have to either reduce a rank in pay or take a different type of position. And being an infantry soldier, I wanted to be with the soldiers that I was training. So I wasn't really looking at it an administrative type of job. I wanted to be with my fellows. So anyways, the position was eliminated. I didn't go. I even had work. They were waiting for me. Everybody was waiting for me. What are you doing, Joel? Are you going? Are you not going? I don't know. Things were not good at home. But my choice in my mind in the Joel show was I'm going to do what I want. And I'm not getting what I want here, so I will find it. And I did that for a while, longer than I should have. And I harmed a lot of people, and I know that. When it came time to stop drinking, about a year and a half into that, slip. I think that's a slip. I haven't really defined it at this point, but going back drinking, it took me about a year and a half of challenges along that time. My kids, fortunately for me, had never seen me drunk, and they were actually quite surprised when they saw me with a beer and having a beer. They were young at that time, though, and my boys used to say to me, Dad, why don't you have a beer fridge in the garage like everybody else? And I'm like, well, I don't have one. I don't need one. I don't want one. Okay. And it was kind of like that. It wasn't particularly odd for them, I don't think, to not see me drink, but it was, they were surprised by it. They, again, never saw me drunk, but I'd been hungover a number of times in that year and a half as I had gone back drinking. By this point, I had left my marriage. I had my own place for a short amount of time. My brother was so nice to let me crash on his couch, which, again, for somebody who's 30 so years old and having a house and everything that goes with it, it's kind of not humbling, it's embarrassing, right? And kind of worked through that and got my own place. But it took a few more really good drunks to know that I had a problem and it was out of control. Part of it was I wanted my old life back, even though it was a toxic relationship and probably wasn't going to work, but I wanted my house back. I wanted my dog back. I wanted my kids back. And I kind of wanted my wife back. So in the order of all that, the one that probably should have been, really important wasn't. And that's, kind of interesting for me when I reflect back on it, because what was more important to me? My kids were most important to me. That was the number one. But I kind of already had them. Right? I sort of had them because I was a shift worker. So I really only got to see them some of the time anyways. So it worked out actually pretty good for me. The dog, again, I could kind of pick her up whenever I wanted because my wife at the time didn't really particularly have all that much time for the dog. And as far as the house goes, well, I just wanted my house. I wanted my house back. I mean, I'm paying for it anyways. Why am I not in it? This really sucks. It's expensive. C'est la vie, mon ami. So after a mess dinner, I decided to drink and drive, even though a number of people had said, you know what, probably not a good plan to be driving. Ah, don't worry about it. I'm good to go. To the point where it's almost like paranoia, where I walked out and I had to walk down the street because we're now at a house party with my colleagues. And I know that one of them was watching me. I'm like, would you leave me alone? Let me do what I want to do. Hey, you want us to call you a cab? No, I'm good. So when they finally had kind of given up, that's when I decided to drive. I was lucky. I didn't hit anybody. Nobody hit me. But I got pulled over by the cops. And fortunately for me, I knew one of them. And he's like, all right. Because I was a block away from home, literally a block away. We'd been following you for a couple of blocks. We know that we saw you driving. You're very drunk. You shouldn't be driving. Yeah, I know. Sorry, boys, sorry. What are we going to do? I said, you do what you have to do. Because at this point in my life, I didn't really care. Whatever. You do whatever you got to do. So I said, all right. And the one guy had been in AA. And he said, you know, Joel, you're a good stand-up guy. I know you. This is a bad choice that you have made, and you need some help. We promise me you're going to get some help. I'll give you a ride home. And nobody needs to know about this. I said, oh, thank God. Yeah, absolutely, man, absolutely. So he gave me a ride home, left my car like a block away. That's where it stayed. My beat up old Ford Explorer, because that's all I could afford at that time. It was a fun little truck, but slightly embarrassing when I had something a lot better before. But c'est la vie, mon ami. The next morning I woke up embarrassed, just thoroughly disgusted in myself, thinking, what am I going to do? I'm never going to be able to face these people again. I'm not going to be able to go to work. What's going to happen? What's going to happen to my job? What's going to happen to my family? What's going to happen when my wife finds out? My life is over. But somehow, somewhere in that foggy mind, something came up. You need to go to AA. Oh yeah, that's what he said the night before. And somebody had been to AA about 12 years before. This guy. So I knew it was out there. I didn't know what it was about. And I knew some guys from work had gone to AA when they got into trouble. Good catch, eh? When they got into trouble, they'd gone to AA. One of them, court appointed, he had to go because a court told him to. The other one, because he knew that that's what he needed to do. So I gave one of these guys a call. He wasn't in AA anymore. I said, yeah, no problem, Joel. I'll get you. I got a contact. I'll get you hooked up. And kind of white knuckled it, because I was at that point I was binging. It was more binge drinking at that point. So I'm like, I could probably make it a couple of days, but I'm like, past that, I'm gonna need some vino. And so part of me was, how am I going to make it? How am I gonna make it that far? So I was fortunate. I was able to go in a meeting quickly. And I wanted to go. I wanted to go to the meeting. I didn't even need to be held. I didn't actually want anybody holding my hand, taking me there. I wanted to do it on my own. Again, ego. Yeah, you bet. Huge. Ridiculous. Still. So when I got to that meeting, I knew that there was one guy that would be waiting for me to guide me in. And as I drove up, I kind of identified who he was on the front step, and I purposely parked far enough around and came in the other way and went down into the basement. And that's where my friend Randy was. And he quickly sized me up and figured, okay, this is Joel. Introduced himself. We sat down, and then the second guy introduced himself, and I definitely could have said, yeah, I saw you waiting out there, but I completely gave you the salmon eye and went the other way, but I didn't. But he's a good friend too, and so at Mustard Seed we sit in a big circle, and they literally were on the left and right of me, And in my background in work and things like that, I kind of know what that is. So I was like, okay, I'm just whatever. I'm here. And when I look at the guy who's chairing the meeting, an old army guy I used to drink with. Wow. How crazy is that? I'm a huge, huge believer that everything happens for a reason. Huge. And this is one of them. This is one of those moments. So as I reflect back now, and having just completed a birthday on the 17th, right, Randy? 17th of October. You know, that's a number of years ago now, and it's gone by pretty quickly. So that first little while in AA, when I came back willingly and I wanted to, all the sayings that I thought were cliche were not anymore. These steps and these traditions meant something to me. The same way the principles of leadership to me mean something, so do these steps and these traditions. I didn't really understand them at first, and again, I was still quite foggy, and my mind wasn't completely clear, but it was clear enough to know that if I wanted sobriety, which I once thought equated to not drinking, I truly believed that if I wanted sobriety, it had to be the AA program and listening openly to what was being told and what was being said and what was being suggested to me, and not to take anything personally, and to grow. I came back to AA because I wanted my life to slow down. It was like high speed. Everything was going fast in my life. Shift work was fast. My Ford Explorer was fast. Except on bumpy roads. My relationships were fast, far too frequent. And I was starting to lose sight of self. I had no idea, really. Really no idea who I was at that point. I had a loose belief of who I was and what I stood for, but by that point, a lot of that was deflated by embarrassment and thinking of worthlessness and lack of hope. Remember after that first meeting, Randy said to me, so how many meetings are you planning on going to? I'm like, I don't know. This looks good. I can handle this once a week. It's like, yeah, no, maybe you should think about going to a few more than that. I'm like, what, two, three, what? He said, well, you'll figure it out, but there's lots of meetings. And you know what, team? I'm glad that he said that to me the way that he did. Because if I was directed to, okay, you're going to go to this many meetings a week, and I'm going to see you there, and you're going to be there, you know what? Sorry. Me no likey. So it was a good way to work that initial part for me. And it was successful for me because I found morning meetings that work really well for me, just the way the shift work was at that time. Even if I was coming off a night shift, I'd drag my butt to that meeting and then I'd go to sleep afterwards. Or if I was starting my day, I'd purposely make sure that I go to that morning meeting to start that day out. And I've done that for a number of years now and it's worked out really well. But initially, you know, I went to morning meetings and I went to evening meetings. I went to as many as I could. They say 90 meetings in 90 days. I have no idea how many I went to. But there's a reason for that. For anybody that's heard of the workout video P90X, okay, so P is for physical, 90 RX. RX is prescribed. That's the medical term, RX, prescribed. So it's prescribed that you do 90. 90 days of physical activity, you will, your body will change. It just will. 90 days of meetings, your mind will change. We know that. It's prescribed. It's also suggested because it's a little bit different in our programs. My first year went by pretty quickly, actually. And I was, again, fortunate that the craving for alcohol left quite quickly again. I was thankful for that. I replaced it with other things, though. And it's that 10 years that I didn't drink alcohol, I replaced it with other things, too. I replaced it with physical activity. So I'm a huge believer in a holistic way of living, the physical, mental, spiritual, and emotional portion. And I think what I did, looking back at it now, is I took that pie and I spread it huge on the physical portion. I left out the spiritual and the mental. Oh, definitely, there's no question. And when I look back at it now, that's how I think, and I don't think successful is the right word, but that's how I didn't drink. Because everything else was definitely alcoholic. My relationships, personal, work, alcoholic. Everything was my way. So, going back, skipping back here to early in recovery. That the program was good for me, and I liked the steps. And it was told to me that, you know, you do the steps in order. And for step four, I'd done it a lot up here, and it stayed up here in the mind quite a bit, but until I actually put it down to paper, that's where the actual release was. I was able to physically let go of those concerns or those things that I thought were so dark and evil. Excuse me. I think it took me about a year before I actually did my step five. And it was kind of an interesting way of doing it, too. So I wanted to do it with a person of the cloth. That's just what I want to do. I grew up Anglican. No problems with the church. I just decided not to go back. That's all. But I wanted to do it with a minister or something like that. I used to joke that I would do it on the top of a mountain with a monk. And then I would just leave and I'd never have to deal with any of it ever again. But that was just kind of in my mind. So I was given the name of a gentleman who's also in the program, and I called him up, and I got his voicemail. And, I mean, I was anxious. Like, I was motivated to do my step five. I'm like, Kate, it's go time. I'm ready. Got it all written down. Everything's on there. I didn't miss a thing. Thoroughly honest. So I call him up. Voicemail. Please leave a message. Okay, no problem. I'll leave a message. Calls me back and leaves a message on my phone. I call him back again, leave another message on his phone. Like, this is going back for, I'm like, is this part of the test? Am I being tested? Is this patience? Is this what I'm looking for? So finally I was able to meet up with him and we did, I was able to do the step five. And afterwards, you know, he just kind of looked at me and he goes, so that's it? I'm like, yeah, that's all of it. He goes, it's not that bad. I'm like, well, it's not. Like, a lot of these things, for most of us, at least for me, were on my shoulders so much that it weighed me down. It weighed me down in a lot of things. And where it weighed me down the most was to back into that escapism with alcohol, that emotional, that feeling part. And after that was done, you know, it was a relief, I think. I think it was a relief that it was done. And I felt a sense of accomplishment and a sense of belonging to something more than just an idea. So it took me a while before I did that step. But as soon as I had done that, the other steps were able to segue in quite quickly. And I think a lot of these steps that we look at, we have these already. We've either learned a lot of these as young people. I don't think all of these steps are foreign to us. I think it's just we're not disciplined enough to practice them. So that was something that also I had to bring in. And I've always kind of thought that I was a disciplined person in a lot of things, and I am. But what I wasn't disciplined in is the rigorous honesty that it takes to be sober. And again, not equating sobriety just to not drinking. It's living these steps to the best of our abilities each day. So once I was able to do that and move forward, you know what? Things definitely got better. I did go through a divorce. It was nasty, sucked, it was expensive, hurt, it was painful, it was embarrassing. But on the other side, I think it was better. I think it was better for all of us. I think had we tried to get back together, I think that the environment was far too toxic, and a couple of things would have happened. One, I would have gone back drinking. I'm quite confident of that. The other thing is that, you know what, that relationship just wouldn't have worked. And then what's on the other side? It's the children who are affected by that. So it was, in my mind, the choice I had to make. It's like they say in the book, you will have to make certain choices. You will have to do certain things. And you need to be disciplined enough to follow through with that. I think there was a part of me, too, that needed Al-Anon. I mean, I certainly was an enabler in a lot of things in my relationship. But it wasn't until I had really gotten sober and gotten to AA was I able to even recognize or realize any of that. So I did go to some Al-Anon meetings. It took me a while before I went. But I'd gone to a few. I haven't really gone back, though, to be quite honest with you. And there's really no reason why I haven't, but I just haven't. But what I liked about the Al-Anon program was not that it kind of mirrors the AA program. That's not why I like it. What I liked about it is some of the literature that is in Al-Anon and some of the key phrases that are in Al-Anon. I think they're very powerful and they're very, very useful, and I definitely use some of them. So once that relationship was, that marriage was done, we're on our own. We're kind of living our separate lives. The other things, the promises in the book there, you know, financial will come back. Yeah, it's good. Things are much more manageable as far as that goes. And that used to be a huge weight on my shoulder, even when I was in my 10 years of time out from drinking. Money was always an issue. And I wanted to be able to be a good example to my family and friends. Being a leader in the community is a big thing for me. And I wanted to ensure that my kids were proud and they could say, that's my dad. And that I could teach them lessons. I think as parents, that's how we feel about all our kids. We want to see them do better. We want to see them be successful. So, you know, plugging along in AA was going good. I'd hit my bottom. And I truly feel I have. I don't think I'm going to go back drinking. I can't guarantee it, but I used to tell my son, Max, there's a difference between being confident and being cocky. And so I'm pretty confident that I'm not going to go back drinking. And I hope that I don't sound like I'm cocky about it, because that's the last thing I want to sound like. So, you know, things are going pretty good there for quite some time, and they still are. Life is pretty good. There's some bad days, though, right? We all experience them in different things, work, relationships, personal, intimate, and work relationships. The portion when I talk about the holistic way of living, I'm still a true believer in that, and I think that there needs to be a good balance. And I know for me, AA provides that guide so that I've got balance and that I can deal with things that I didn't think I could before. And you will intuitively know how to deal with things that baffled you before, because you'll be able to do what we say in the military, take a tactical pause, reassess, and deal with it. And hopefully deal with it in a confident and correct manner. And if we don't, there's also some steps in here that help us out in correcting that. But it's being able to understand when that needs to segue in, when you need to be able to do that. And only you can do that, and we know that. Things were going really good up till about 2 years ago. On March the 8th, 2014, my 16-year-old son committed suicide. Yeah, Max is his name. Love that boy. Oh, looked just like me, like identical. And I loved it when people would say, you look just like your dad, and he'd look at me and he'd kind of smile. Smart kid, good in school, athletics, great little soccer player. I used to joke around and tell him, well, I've taught you all I can. He goes, no, you haven't. Come on, let's go. And we go kick the ball around. Love that boy. You know, the week before Max passed, actually 2 weeks before, we had spent all of the February break together, my oldest son, Zach, Max, and my daughter, Neve. We had spent the time together, and my other daughter, Kira. And we'd gone skiing in Fernie. We'd done that for 3 years. Every year we'd go skiing for the February break. And he had become a pretty strong kid. Healthy, active. Challenging time. He knew that I'd gone to AA, and Max actually, the day I did my step five, babysat, looked after his little sister so I could go. He looked after, he was 10 years old, and he looked after his sister for me so I could do my step five. So thankful for that. So he knew about AA. He knew that, and he was at that point where most 16-year-olds, myself included, starting to drink. Max is starting to experiment in pot. And the smokeless cigarettes. He knew that I didn't smoke and I didn't drink. And that I try to live a healthy lifestyle. He wanted to be a part of that. And he was starting to. Challenging time for teenagers right now. Social media, everything that goes with that. So the week before Max took his life, it was a Sunday, and it was an open meeting at Mustard Seed. And Max said to me, hey, Dad, where are you going? I said, oh, I'm going to my meeting. He goes, hey, can I come with you? I'm like, yeah, absolutely. Because I'd asked him to go to meetings before. And I'd even suggested to him, after speaking with his mom, that I take him to an NA meeting, which I'd never been to, but I'd go. Or I'd take him to an AA meeting. And she said, yeah, he needs to go. You gotta do something, Joel. Because she wasn't willing to. And AA meeting, one of my good friends was speaking for AA. And he told his story. And his story went something similar to mine, slightly different, but talked about how his kids had never seen him drunk. Max would look, kind of sitting right beside me, he'd look over at me and goes, never seen you drunk. I go, nope. But I have. Talked about the challenges he had with his wife and the imbalance and sort of instability of that relationship in that home. Max is really young when all that kind of went down. So Max kind of looked at me and goes, kind of sounds familiar, hey? And he kind of smiled. And I'm like, yeah. So then the Al-Anon speaker came up. And no offense to Al-Anon at all. And I hope nobody takes it the wrong way. Usually it's older ladies who speak at Al-Anon. Usually. Just generally speaking. So I hope nobody is offended by that. This time there is a younger gentleman there. And he told his story. And he told the story about plates flying around the house, smashing. And Max looked at me. He goes, that sounds familiar. I'm like, yep, that does, doesn't it? Told the story about growing up in an alcoholic home, being young. And I could see the connection Max is having right there. It's like, geez. And then he finished off talking about, you know what? There's not a lot of young kids come to Al-Anon or AA, and they should. And that was the message that I was trying to say to Max for a couple years. Good year anyways. Good solid year. And he looked at me, goes, well, maybe I'll go to his group. He seems kind of cool. It's like, yeah, probably be good to go see him. And then after that meeting, as we were standing around, Max had gotten this kind of cool, fresh haircut, kind of jazzy. He liked Cristiano Ronaldo, who's a soccer player, Portuguese soccer player. Kind of tried to style himself like him. And one of the fellows came over and said, Max, I like your fresh haircut. And Max just kind of laughed. And another guy came over and said, you look just like your dad. I said, yeah. So, you know, not often do you think you're going to hit a bottom when you've been sober. And what I learned was that when you do, if you have a strong AA, you will intuitively know what to do. And the other part of that is that I know that Max was having some challenges. And I don't believe that he intentionally tried to kill himself. And I'll tell you why. I have the privilege of information that a lot of people don't get. So I was able to get his cell phone and have it analytically, forensically checked. Every message that went out of that phone for 2 weeks before and the day of. And I was also able to get his email and his game station that he was on. Anybody that games out there or kids that game, it's a whole virtual world they live in. It's a whole virtual world. And there wasn't one red flag. There was nothing. There wasn't a note saying, Dad, I hate you. Mom, I hate you. Why did you get divorced? There's none of that. There was none. Zach, I hate you because you're my older brother. There's nothing. Neve, I hate you because you get all the attention because you're the younger sister. There's nothing. And I also know that alcohol was a contributing factor to his suicide. He had stolen alcohol from his mother's house. I'm not angry or disappointed or anything like that for the alcohol that he stole from their home. And I'm also, you know, that's where he decided to end his life, was at his mother's house, that house on Arbor Creek that I wanted back to so badly. And you know, the other part of that, the choices that were made and the cunning, baffling, powerful effect that alcohol has on the mind, and especially a young mind, a developing mind, it was definitely a contributing factor. There's no doubt in my mind at all, no question. And when I talked to the investigators afterwards, because the major crimes have to come in to investigate, I was quite candid with them. And I told them, you need to tell me if there's something that I should know about. Something that I'm missing, something that I've missed. And they said, okay. And afterwards, about a week or so later, he came and met me. He turned over his journal to me. And they said, Joel, there's nothing in here. There's nothing. And I told him, I said, you guys know I'm going to check the pages to see if anything's been ripped out. You guys know that, right? And they're like, yeah, we know. You know, I'm going to pencil over to see if there's impressions on the next page. You guys know that, right? They're like, yeah, Joel, we know. I said, okay. The report came back from the forensic investigation on the cell phone and also from the email traffic and the game, the PlayStation 2, because he was gaming right up to the time he decided. And the discussion on there and the Snapchats that were taking place. So if you could imagine on a cul-de-sac, so the cul-de-sacs are quite small. Max's house is in the middle. His best friend is about 9 houses down, and there's actually an eye line of sight to the 2 houses. And then the next crescent over, there's another kid. 2 crescents over, there's another kid. There's 8 kids that are all texting, game station playing, emailing from about 10 p.m. till the time somebody Snapchats a cop car outside the front of his house. Like, it's so bizarre. It's like out of one of those movies where there's bubbles of conversations going on, because that's exactly how it is. And it's so hard to imagine seeing the end of somebody's life as it's being played out. And there's even one point in that timeline where he's telling another person, hey, you got to stop drinking. And in that timeline, there's a conversation where he tells a girl, you got to tell your dad to stop being so drunk and doing that to you. So it kind of leaves your mind to imagine what's really going on in their worlds. It's surprising how when you feel like you're empty, like an empty glass, that you don't ever think it'll be refilled. It takes time. They say, again, time heals everything. I would challenge that. But what I don't challenge is the fact that if it wasn't for Alcoholics Anonymous, these steps, the principles, the fellowship, I wouldn't be here. I didn't go back drinking. I went to his house, like where his mom lives. Man, there was booze flying everywhere there. Everybody was coming in for drinks. And I was like, just numb. I'd never felt numb before. I'd heard people talk about that, and I've dealt with people. How are you feeling? I feel numb. I'd never experienced that before. I've felt pain. I had to be on morphine IV. I know what pain is. I know what hurt is. I know what sadness is. But I never knew what empty was before. Physically feeling empty. And physically and emotionally feeling lost. I'm at 64 minutes here, team. I'm going to wrap it up right away. But what I want you to know is that life continues on. So each day I honor my son, Max, and I tribute him in everything I do because I live. And I try to share the message. And I try to practice principles in all my affairs to the best of my ability each and every single day in everything I do. And I don't think that it's cliche because I know it's not. So when I see a new person come in and they're feeling despair or disgust or hopelessness, lack of hope, I remember that. And it helps me, but I know that they need the help too. I'm fortunate to be able to travel around northern Saskatchewan. I've been to 17 different northern communities in the last few years. And the last one I was in was La Loche and Hatchet Lake. Both are Dene communities, but both very diversely different. One is a fly-in only, The other one is kind of at the end of the road, literally. Both have their challenges with alcohol, mental health issues. And what I learned from the two communities is that I now have a better sense of direction in what I'm doing when I'm going up to those communities and providing health and wellness programming. It's about allowing the opportunity to learn about discipline. And I'm not saying from a militant type of way, discipline. When I say discipline, because it equates to hope, not hopelessness. And you have hope. If you have discipline in your life, you will have hope. Program talks about discipline, but in a different way. I think that if I am disciplined enough to know that if I wake up in the morning, I give thanks for what I have, and I pray for others before self, and I pray for those people who I particularly may not like too much and are not on my Christmas card list, I know it's better for me to pray for them than to hate, despise, discourage, talk poorly of. And it gives me hope because I know that, you know what, it'll get better. This program works. There's no doubt in my mind. And I know that if you want sobriety, and I say this often at meetings, then you've got to work for it. It will not come easy. And when you have it, you'll know it. But don't be cocky. Be confident. And work at it every single day. Thank you very much for your time, and I hope you guys have a good 24.